Okay, today I have, like I said before, today we have Juha-Pekka Tolvanen from Metacase, and this is your chance to ask of these things. He's a true pioneer in this field, has been doing this for more than 20 years. You can explain more yourself if you like. And he can explain this much better than I do. We continue a bit next lecture next week about this, but he can answer your questions way better than I ever do. So, stage is yours.
Thanks. So, good afternoon for everybody. My name is Juha-Pekka. I'll have a prepared few slides. I'm afraid that maybe too many slides, and I would maybe like to go in many into details. But my plan is to give an overall idea what a modeling means, why you should be interested, and what are the benefits it can provide. And then I also try to make this a little bit entertaining. So I'll show a demonstration, hopefully some jokes. And if you don't ask anything, I will ask you. Okay? Because the best way to get people silent is to ask, do you have a question? So a few words about me. I started here at 80s to study computer science. And I started at that point of time when we were still forced to make at least one program in assembler language. We were not forced to make our own hardware, but just on the software side. And I did my master thesis and license thesis and doctoral dissertation in this topic, and then I have been working in industry quite a long time. However, I have still a hobby because of my background. I still like to do the research, and I, for some weird reason, I still like to write articles, even though I don't get any academic benefit of that. So let's get started. This is about modeling. When you go to many places, people draw in a whiteboard, in a blackboard, in a back of envelope, napkin, or whatever. They draw all kind of designs because the world is complex. We can't understand and explain everything, so we can make a matrices or diagrams like these to discuss or collaborate and do things. But the essence of modeling is that when I draw something, how I can be sure that you understand what I'm modeling or drawing. So quite often you have the case that someone is making a model on an architecture and explaining this, and the other guy is asking, well, what the yellow, green, and blue stuff are about. And quite often then the answer is that, oh, they're just boxes. So each person makes their own interpretation. And this is a one sort of modeling, which is fine, but I'm not so much keen on this kind of modeling. I would like that these models are precise and formal, and I could do something with the models, like saying that if this system breaks down, where it will influence, or in which systems we have information about persons. Or could I even analyze the bottlenecks of the system based on these models? Or, like I will show in this session, could we even generate the code? So we don't need to write the code manually, but actually from the pictures we get the code. Or test cases or configuration and so forth. And the reasons why we normally do models is that we have a lot of many levels of detail. Different people have different views. Some might be interested on safety or security. Others are on functionality, access rights, persistency, and so forth. And then things are uncertain, so we don't know that if we are changing something, what it will influence to, and so forth. And unfortunately, in this field, modeling, and I'm not speaking about the type of modeling. If you do a Google search, you will get quite a different views of modeling, but I'm more speaking about various kind of models applied for software engineering. And unfortunately, we have a lot of different terminology applied in this field. But the general consensus is that the whole idea is that we don't do software anymore in a manner that we only do program code, but we try to raise the level of abstraction to higher and use matrices, visualizations, and tables in order to produce the code or configuration or test or whatever. Any questions? So my question to you is that what this is? And this will be a very, very dull recording if you don't answer. Any idea what this expresses? Obviously, it's a model, but what the model expresses? Exactly. It's an automation system, but in more precisely, this is a fish farm. The blue things, the ellipses, are ponds. They are the places where the fishes are swimming and growing. And then you can see that there are different kind of ponds. Some ponds have aerators to give enough air to the water. Some might have a feeding machine to give food for the fishes, or monitor them, how muddy is the water, and so forth. And the whole idea in this idea is that this is a domain-specific model. We can't use this kind of model to express a banking system or a car system, but automation system, because you can see different kind of network configuration. But you can also see that this is a domain-specific because this only can be used to build fish farms. And the idea here is that we can use this model to actually build the whole system. And a large portion of companies today, when they build systems, they usually build a system so that they have these kind of abstract models, like the guys in the joke in the beginning had. They draw something to illustrate the idea, and then they give those ideas to the programmers and say, figure it out and produce the code. And normally happens then that the models and code are quite a separate things, and the poor programmer gets the vague ideas what it should be, and then he sees that, oh, there's 20 different alternatives to implement it, and he picks one. And the likelihood that he picks the correct one is not so big. And this is the most companies still do today, the software. And the model could be something like a requirements, it could be an analysis, or it could be a detailed design or specification. Another approach, if you go to industries which are a little bit maybe more major, like automotive, in automotive, they use tools like MATLAB Simulink, where they design the control flow, how the brakes, for example, works. And from such a model, they can generate the braking code. So if you are driving today a car like which has an ABS braking system, they haven't been programmed that manually. It is generated from the control models that describe the physical behavior on how the tires are cycling and so forth. But the tool developer, in this case a MATLAB, if I use the Simulink as an example, they stated how the generated codes look like. So the modelers don't need to even think about how the code looks like. They just focus on the problem. The same applies also if you are maybe building a database system, a relational database. You can define the schema, what kind of concepts you have. You can normalize the model, and then the tool, a proper tool, should produce you the schema table creation command that builds the normalized database with the keys and primary keys and references all set. So that's another area where we use a high-level model, and then we generate the code. Another approach that the people are also using is trying to use a reverse engineering, that you have an existing code, but you can't figure it out what it is doing, so you want to visualize it somehow to get a better picture. Many people are using some kind of a class. If you're using programming languages like Java, you may use documentation generation capabilities that gives you an illustration of your code in a model that you can a little bit better understand what it all makes. But obviously, my color coding here means the blue for the model here, because you don't get the problem in the fish farm or braking system. You get the model of your code, not the model of your braking system. So you get actually model of your implementation. And the holy grail for some time was that it was that you would have a round tripping, that it wouldn't matter if you are modeling or programming, somehow in a miracle, they are always in sync. In some cases, it works, but in most cases, it doesn't. And because the aspiration to raise the level of abstraction has been very high, there has been a number of standards and standardization bodies like OMG who have tried to make a general model, how to use a general approach or architecture, how to use models. So the idea here is that you build a highly abstract model, and then you run a transformation that produces another more detailed model that you modify, run a transformation, and you get even more detailed model until you finally get the code. And this is the model-driven architecture idea. You build a model, then yet another model and further details. So you can think that this something like a customer makes some highly specified requirements model, gives it to the further steps, who edits it further and until you get the code. And if you look deep into a compilers work like that way. So when you write your code, let's say C code, you press the compile. Inside the compiler, it actually builds internal representations of the model until it spits out the binary. Except here in MDA, it expects that you modify the model in this flow of model transformations. Of course, when you are using a compiler, you don't touch the generated code. Except if you were like a lazy guy like me, who was forced to do this one assembler program, we used the C program and asked the C development tool to show us the assembler, which we could then modify and show to the lecturer that, yes, we built the assembler program. Because you have these transformations there. These are agnostic. These are totally agnostic. Maybe the main area where the language is really fixed is that if you pick the second here, the case or Simulink, normally the tool vendor builds you the code generator, and that is normally specific for a language that they prefer. So if you have, let's say, you have a UML tool, you can generate easily Java skeleton code. But you can't generate functional code, functional programming code so easily anymore, because the mapping from the UML is different, works for different style of programming languages. And the last part that I'm actually presenting here is domain-specific modeling, which is very similar to the second step here, except that the person can build the modeling language and can build a code generator. So you have freedom to decide how you want to model and what you want to generate. And obviously, if you find a tool that makes this everything for you, there's no reason for you to build your own language and generators, because there is already a working solution. But in many cases, you don't have such, and then it could be beneficiary to build such a visualization, such a tool, and generate the code. Few words about the approach on code visualization and round-tripping and why it doesn't work. This goes a little bit into details, but here you can see the typical view of a modeling tool on the left and the generated code on the right. So they are basically the same thing. And this is not normally something that software developers particularly like. They don't want to draw a model to get the same kind of output they already get now today manually, because they are the same. They don't want to use the extra work. So therefore, the modeling level should be higher to generate more. So here's an example of layers of abstraction. I was joking that when I was a student, I was able to do this kind of code, assembler code. And obviously, after that, all the software in this planet is written with two characters, zeros and ones, in a binary. But obviously, nobody writes the code in a binary anymore, because it requires heavy thinking, a lot of time, and tracing from one and zero to the customer requirements is quite long. So therefore, what has happened in our industry in past 30 years, 50 years, is that we have tried to have higher level languages that we always map to the lower language level. So here is an example of C code for SMS message sending. So someone makes draws a model like cancel registration. It generates the code, which the compiler compiles to assembler, which then it makes the binary code that we execute. But obviously, for reverse engineering, we can't do such a thing, because there is nothing to find out from the binary back to higher abstraction level. That's why the round-tripping kind of approach does not work. I ask about the fish farms. So the fish farm is a true example, and I use this as an example just to illustrate the idea of domain-specific modeling and what the benefits it can provide. So this is a true fish farm in Radenheim in Austria. So there's a company which makes fish farm automation systems. Each customer is different. There's no two fish farms alike. So it wouldn't be wise for a fish farm company to build fish farm systems in an agile manner, where it would go each time to the customer and ask what you want and build everything again from the scratch using a Scrum and whatever. It would be a stupid thing to do. And one of the key ideas that everybody agrees in software development is try principle. Don't repeat yourself. Whatever you have a possibility, always automate. So this company has decided, look, we have all the fish farms have ponds. So then they look how the ponds can be different among the customers. Some may have aerators, some may have feeding machines, some may have lights, whatever. And they build then a domain-specific language that you can see here, the blue concept. It's one of the modeling concepts here in the toolbar. And if they want to build a new fish farm with a new additional pond, they choose from the toolbar and click and position it in the pond. And then the language asks, oh, does it have an aerator? Does it have a feeding machine? And so forth. So they ask questions that are specific for ponds and pond automation. They don't may ask, for example, how deep the pond is. If it's not relevant for generating the software or tests, well, we don't ask that kind of question. Only those kind of questions that are relevant will be asked. And then they have here in the toolbar a number of buttons that they can click, making this something that people see sometimes a miracle, because it generates the code needed for the automation system. So, for instance, if you look at this diagram, the reason why the ponds are such a way because they are in the same way in the river or lake. because they also generate for the iPad of the fish farm owner a view of the very same that you can see in the diagram. So if you click the pond, the fish farm owner can see and look how the fishes are doing, or maybe feed them or whatever. But they also generate the SQL databases because they will also want to store information about what is the status of the fishes in a persistent manner. Not only the current status, but also the past history. And they also generate the program code that they can launch things like provide food for the fishes or whatever. And they also generate the configuration depending on how the wiring goes. And they even go so detailed that they also generate documentation and installation guidance. So if you think that the guy is rowing on the lake, it would be nice to have some plan. Otherwise, you are rowing there a lot. So they generate the plan for install it. And they even go so long that they generate labels for the wiring closet. So when the guy goes and installs the software and he plugs the network there, the stickers where this wire goes, it's also generated from the model. And this has now the major implication why a company has decided to build their own modeling language. Because if something changes, they only change it in one place. And they generate all the rest. Whereas the traditional manual approach is that you have programmers who write the program code, and then there are other guys who make the database tables, and then, someone writes the installation guidance, and so forth. And they are not normally, at the end, they are not consistent. With this approach, they can be sure that all the details that they are generating, they are consistent. They could be wrong, but if they are wrong, then the errors are everywhere in a similar manner. So this is the idea of domain-specific modeling. There's a lot of research done. I pick some research findings you can find if you want to look the state of the art of model-based development. John Hutchinson has done a detailed study, over 400 people interviewed, asking all kind of questions that what are the influences of this. So the highest here in the top, you can see that use of models for team communication, how has it increased the productivity? So even the guys in my joke, in my first slide, who draw models just for communication, 93% of all the people use some kind of models based on this study. And 73% thinks that it improves the productivity if we are able to draw sketches or whatever. So if you want to look at details of this, please take a view for the references. But the whole idea here with models is that the whole history of software engineering is that of raising the level of abstraction. If we would be still programming things in assembler, things would take quite a lot of time. And some companies like Software Productivity Research, Caper Jones, has done a lot of empirical study analyzing thousands of projects depending on how much of lines of code they have had to look what is the influence of a programming language, a particular programming language, to the productivity. And obviously companies who use assembler to implement a feature, it takes much more time compared to companies which use 3GLs like C, because the programmer needs to write less code in C than in assembler, plus all the maintenance of that and so forth. However, if you move into C# or Java, the productivity of programmers based on Caper Jones has not any more increased significantly. So if you use Java compared to C, sure, you can be a little bit more productive, but you don't get a productivity jump similarly that you get from moving from assembler to C. So the idea of having domain-specific languages like the fish farm company, they get again major productivity increase by using using models and generating the code. They raise the level of abstraction. And another study that I also mentioned there from the model-driven engineering state-of-the-art study by John Whittle is that their data states that the companies who successfully applied modeling have built their own modeling languages and code generators. So what this means from the general perspective is that this, in our opinion, in my opinion, this kind of pattern happens every time in every company who builds the software. In the beginning, on the left, there is some idea, like, for instance, I will show an example of a digital watch. And next in the video, I can't use my own computer here, so I use just a recorded a YouTube video there. But the idea here is, in my scenario, is that I would be a developer in a company like Suunto or Polar in Finland, and my boss comes to say that, look, we need a great new functionality that if I keep my button pressed for a long time, it makes something special than if I kept it pressed quickly. A normal old way for doing this at 70s was that that's a great idea, and then the programmer thinks how he's going to implement it in the device that we call sukemittari, but in English we call it heart monitor, wristwatch, wrist heart monitor. Anyway, he would write it in an assembly language, and obviously the idea that we want to have double clicking button pressing policy to write it right in the assembler, move from register AX to BX, would take a lot of time. So therefore, most of them have moved to higher level languages like C, where they can do the same thing, and the step from the programmer point of view on what is required is a little bit smaller. He doesn't need to do so big jump mentally to get it right to the code. And then if you use modeling languages, you can do it even further. Because with the UML model, for instance, that you have also been introduced to, we can describe the functionality in more abstract terms. However, use of UML for code generation is problematic because it does not allow to generate the full code. It normally generates the skeleton code, and then the programmer adds further bits to the generated code manually. And usually when he touches the generated code, he throws the UML models away because it's so much effort to keep the models in sync on what I have written. And the idea of domain-specific modeling would mean that we have a modeling language, not like a fish farm, but a digital watch or heart rate monitor-specific language. So what it would look like in practice, I'll show here with the YouTube video, just that you will get the idea. So this is an example of describing a stopwatch application. So I'm running, and I can take the time, how long it takes to run. And in this scenario, I'm adding here lap time functionality. So if I run one circle, I can stop my time lap. And here I'm using a domain-specific language. And here in the toolbar, we can see the domain concepts of the modeling language. So there are concepts here on the top here, concepts like alarms, actions, buttons, icons. So here's an up button, for instance. And all the modeling here is not done in terms of Java, although we can generate the Java here. Or in case of C, or in case of C#, but we are using high-level modeling concepts here. And obviously, I think we are doing the meta-modeling part here, sorry. So this is not the right video, but the whole idea here is that we add here a concept like pressing an up button, and then we show an icon. So the modeling language operates with the concepts of the problem domain, not its concepts in the implementation. Yet the code can be generated from here. But I'm not able to show it now to you, but if I would be doing some time with YouTube, I could find it, but I'm not going to do it. That is your exercise. So what the domain-specific modeling means is that the modeling language is not like UML, where you are modeling classes, attributes, inheritance, but you are actually modeling the problem domain, whether it would be a banking or insurance or fish farm or a watch. And someone has built the language, like for me, someone has been building the watch language or the fish farm language. And I can focus on the business problem, like how the fish farm should work, and not to think about, did I remember to reserve a memory or use calloc and malloc in C properly. Generator handles that part. And this requires that this bottom approach to work, it requires that someone implements first the modeling language for me, as well as build the code generator. And then if there are existing assets, like in the framework, obviously we can use them. So we don't need to generate all the code. Just like today, if you are programming, you don't program all the code. You normally use some libraries. So the same here, the code generator can call for libraries. So you don't. It doesn't mean that every final bit of the code is generated from the model. And so this basically means that the person who is experienced in that particle field defines the language and generator, and then others can apply it. And the pros and cons of this approach is that this gives basically a fundamental increase in productivity. If you can imagine with the fish farm, if everything would be written manually, now there's a big business opportunity for the fish farm because know that the deployment cost for each customer is very small compared to traditional approach. And there is quite a lot of academic research on this area if you want to look. But maybe another, maybe best visible case for us here in Finland has been Nokia mobile phones. So back at the 90s, the competitors of Nokia built something like 5 or 10 different kind of mobile phone models a year. But then at the heydays of Nokia, they were building like 40 or 50 models a year because they were generating those models. They didn't have a legion of programmers to do it all the time again and again, but they could therefore build phones for different customer segments and different price ratios very quickly. Still, all the phones have the same look and feel and usability things. And then the other benefit is that this gives a full control to the company. So if the company builds the language, they can decide if they want to have a double-clicking button policy or long-clicking button policy or whatever that might be. But on the other hand, on the downside, this requires a lot of expertise for someone to first build this language and generator. So it's an investment. They can't just go and buy that. We want to make a fish farm. Someone else would come and say that this is the way you should do it. Only the fish farm company knows how to do it. I think this is an analogy to the development methods that you have in a company which makes a frameworks or a company which is in a product line. They also have a own team who is looking the requirements for the whole family. or for the framework. And then they have another team who looks requirement for a particular product or for a particular customer. So the development methodology is applied for companies who build frameworks or build product lines. They apply also here for building the language and generators.
Have you seen this used in business process
development? Yes. Yes. And another nice aspect of this is that everybody is basically afraid of vendor locking. Nobody wants to be dependent on something else. So if you are picking a particle tool, you are always afraid that, what will happen for the tool in the longer run? It would be nice to be avoid that kind of risk totally. The nice aspect with the tools on building these language and generators is that they don't have any locking, because if you decide to move another tool and you have built a generator, you can obviously take all the models and run a generator that puts them to another tool, because the tool is open. There's no lock for you to do there. However, this is not a solution for all the software engineering problems. This kind of approach works when you have a repetition. So you have a product, you have a base product that you configure for each customer. You have a product line, or you have a case where there's a lot of domain knowledge, let's say from insurance experts who still influence the code. But obviously the insurance experts can't program, but you can build an abstraction for them that they can actually create formal specifications which generate the code. So this approach works when you can apply automation. If you are building a software first ever, this approach is not possible, because you don't know yet what you are building, so it's impossible to automate then what you are building. Then you do in the most agile manner or trial error manner. But if you learn that, then the next time, or the second or third product, it doesn't anymore make sense to build in an agile manner. And everybody likes the idea that we are building something great nobody ever has built. So it might feel tempting to apply agile methods. But at the end of the project, you can see that 95% of my code is what everybody else has done. And the 5% is actually the novel part. But mentally, it's nicer to think that we are always doing something great nobody else has been building. So let's go into a little bit more detail then how we build the languages and how we build the generators. And now I bring the words like modeling and meta-modeling and so forth. I skipped a little bit of the philosophical aspects of the languages, but in many different areas of science, it is generally realized that the language plays an important role how we see the world. So if I don't have in my fish farm language a concept of the depth of the pond, that's irrelevant for me. I can't even speak about that, because I have purposely removed that from my consideration. And the idea of modeling is not new. There are various kind of modeling languages. And if you have been thinking about or seeing UML, I think UML have something like 13 or 14 different kind of modeling languages. But there is yet actually much more. Colleagues of mine did at the University Times, and I extended this further to look actually how the different kind of modeling languages have evolved over time. And I just use this to illustrate you very different kind of languages, that you can get to the idea that by choosing a certain language, you are only looking certain kind of problems. And these are what I call general purpose languages. We can use these languages for banking or fish farm or whatever. And I would like to pick here some of the early things, obviously here from the left, like state machines and petri flows. Petri nets. But here is an idea of what model looks like in a simplicity in a Petri nets. And this describes two systems, people on the bus stand and the bus, and describes what are all the places or states in the system. And the black dots describe the bus or the person. They are called tokens. So in the beginning, persons are waiting on the bus, three, and bus is arriving. And once the bus arrives here, it triggers this condition and one person can get to the bus. But based on this model, the person waiting cannot get to the bus until the bus is at bus stop. And so forth. So all we are looking here is what are the legal flow of tokens in this system. We don't look, for example, what information is about person or what is the register plate of the bus. That's irrelevant. We are only looking what is the legal behavior and so forth. And these kind of languages allow us to look, for example, if the system goes in a deadlock situation, that all the tokens go in a certain manner that the system hangs and never can continue. That kind of problems you can solve. Then another language, this is from UML, maybe you have seen this. This is a state machine which describes a behavior. Like what are all the states that material is arriving to the warehouse, in which all possible states the material in the warehouse can be. And all the rectangles, rounded rectangles, are states of the material in a warehouse. And the arrows describes when the state of the material changes and what influences that the state change happens. And if the state change happens, what action we should perform. But we don't know what is the material. We don't know how much it is there. We just know the behavior of the states. But if you are interested in the data and you are deciding, for example, databases, then you don't interest at all in the behavior. You are describing what are all my conceptual data, how they are related to each other, how many terms they are related, what are the detailed information we have. And from such models, then you can generate, for example, the SQL database. Or you have models like data flow diagrams, where you describe external entities, customer, and then the system is maintaining some processes, making some processes, and storing information into databases or files or whatever. And the whole idea here is coming from structured programming like COBOL, C, where you have a main program, and then you have a subroutines or subprocedures functions. And the whole system is that you have one main in C, and then you have a subroutines under there which you are calling. And the same idea is actually applied here. You have, in the beginning, you have one box, one process, and you say to this box that go into detailed, and you specify subprocesses. And then you take each circle, and you say, oh, this circle is so complex, I can't understand what verify orders mean. I decompose it further, and I have smaller steps, processes, what actually means verifying order. So this is like a divide-conquer approach. You have a big problem, I don't know it, I put into parts based on processes. And then at the end, you have basically subroutines for your COBOL or C or Delphi code, Pascal. Or you have a process models or business process models that was asked about here and so forth. Each of these languages, and now we come to the definition side, each modeling language or even programming language can be said that it has an abstract syntax. It has a concrete syntax. The concrete syntax is the only thing we can see. So when I, for example, started to explain this example for you, you only now see the concrete syntax. You see the bubbles or symbols. Just like in the joke, there was what those green, yellow stuff was. And then I started to explain to you the abstract syntax, saying that the product file, bottom left, is actually a persistency file, database, and so forth. Then you started to know what is the concepts mean, and then there's a semantics that describes their meaning. And when we define the languages, we define the languages by using abstract syntax, concrete syntax, and the semantics. And the semantics can be two kind. When I said you the fish farm example of the pond, there can be semantics like that. Look, we cannot have two fish ponds which are the same. Otherwise, the fish owner or the messages to different ponds would get disturbed if there would be two instances of the fish pond with the same identity. So therefore, they must be unique. That's one of the rules. Or we cannot connect two fish ponds together, or we cannot put them on top of each other, and so forth and so forth. So they are then the semantics describing what is the meaning of these concepts. And then this is the slide that takes that I would require most of your concentration, because now we are speaking about the model, the definition of the model, which is called metamodel, and then the definition of that metamodel. So we are discussing the metamodel. And we stop there. Because standardization organizations like ISO or OMG says that we don't need more. And what these levels basically mean is that at the bottom, at the lowest, we have the system running. I have a wristwatch in my hand, and I can see the time. Or I can see the fish are swimming in the pond. One level higher, I have the program code that runs my C code running in my smartwatch. Today it's called smartwatch. And one level higher, I have a definition of the C programming language that I'm using to write the C code that I have in my hand running. And then the top level is, for example, BNF, which is used to define C code. What is the C language? Sorry, not C code. What is the definition of C language? So if you look some programming languages, they describe the grammar of the programming language. It's normally described the BNF. So here are all the layers. And these layers are nothing new because we also have the same in databases. So if I look Korppi, there's today a lecture which is given by Juha-Pekka. That's the instance. You can see it running in Korppi. On top of that, there is someone who has defined a database to Korppi. There must be a table which says that what are the courses, lectures. And that's the one layer higher. On top of that, there is a SQL, which is most likely the language relational database behind the Korppi. And on top of that is the definition of the SQL. Also, if you have the same thing, if you are, let's say, have an XML file has a content, like, let's say, Juha-Pekka. XML file has also the language definition, and the XML itself is defined with XSD schema for the XML. So all these layers go always in everywhere in the software. But normally, we don't need to master and work with all four at the same time. That would be exploding the brain. We normally need to only work at one. When you are programming, for instance, you only think about, I'm using the programming language to describe the problem. I don't need to think about what it means when this program is run at the customer or how my C or HTML is defined. So normally we only need to work in pairs, and that's why it also tries to show the ISO the pair layers here. And when it comes to the modeling, what we are doing with the modeling, we are looking at the existing system, and then we create the model that tries to represent that system. So the meta-modeling is analogy. We don't look the system, but we look the language, the model, and we create a definition, a meta-model, that represents the modeling language. And let's go into some practical example. I take an example of a digital wristwatch here. So we define a few languages to all the layers for defining digital wristwatches. And I start with a very small one. Not the topmost, but the second layer, defining a parameter. So we say that in our modeling language, we say that we have a parameter, which is a pair of name and value. So each parameter must have a name and a value. And then when we move one layer down in a modeling, we can say that, oh, one of the parameters of our digital wristwatch is that we have time unit, and the time unit is second, not hours, for instance. So when we are running the system, this was actually the generated code, but I couldn't show it. But here we are running the system in my hand. This is the lowest layer. I have a wristwatch running, and I can see 36 seconds. Are you still with me? So here you can see three layers, and the fourth one would be the way how this parameter definition, this one is made. So now our language says that all what we can see is one parameter, name and value. But obviously we can have a lot of parameters, and then we have a little bit different meta model. So now we have a meta model which says that we have actually a parameter list, which is a collection of parameters, and each parameter has a name and value. Therefore, when we are modeling, now we can say that, oh, we have a time unit seconds, but we have also application, which is the name, and the value is timer. So then we can, again, run that kind of application. Or we can have a watch-specific modeling language, where the meta model is such that actually it says that each watch must have a name, set of icons, and how many buttons it has, or even specify what kind of buttons they are. Are they buttons that I can press, or are they buttons that I can rotate? So when we now use this kind of modeling language, now we have an example of describing, this should now follow the meta model here. So we have a watch called name. The watch name is an ace. It has a number of icons. So the watch has three icons. And then it may have hours, minutes, seconds, or hundreds. So here three is selected. And then it has a set of buttons with the name and definition. Are they something that I can press or rotate? So the whole idea of meta-modeling is that if we want to describe from the digital wristwatch products something more specific things, we add the definition to the meta-model, and then we can start using it. And obviously from this kind of a model, we could generate some structural code saying that each ace model has a display which must have three slots for hours, minutes, and seconds. So there must be some variables for them. And also it must have a place for four buttons. And we could at least generate basic initialization that we need these variables. That's the skeleton. But we couldn't, of course, generate the code how the timer would be working. That would require more capabilities from the modeling language. Another illustration is the same from feature modeling. So we have a feature modeling is something that you can use to describe how products members are, what are all the variability in the product. So here on the left you can see a feature model that you can describe. Oh, we have a features. Features may have relations, and then some features are mandatory. Watch must always have a display, but it does not necessarily need to have an icon. That's why the white is in the concrete syntax. Or we may have a more complex meta model to describe also that if we have a button, we must choose if it is a press button or rotate button. And then we come to the domain-specific meta model that I'm not now able to show, but here it says that each logical watch must have a display, and display contains of a set of icons, time units, and buttons. So this definition, the meta model, then allows to build all kind of digital wristwatch structures, saying that what kind of display they have and what kind of logical behavior they may have. And for the case of the logical behavior, there is further detailed meta model. I showed you the state machine example. So here on the left, you can see a very simple state machine on the time. I go to a watch, and then it shows my time. But then if I press the mode button, I can edit the hours, like moving to the summer daylight saving time. Or I can edit my minutes. And here is the meta model for the state machine. You don't need to look at these details, but you just need to understand that in a similar manner, I was defining the parameters. Simple meta model, the same rules apply when we define more complex structures. So here the blue stuff and the meta model is that we have here a button. Button must have a name. So there is a set button. I can't have any other information on buttons than just their name based on this meta model. And then I might have an event. Each button, when I press the button, it can have a connection to the event. And the event can trigger transition. Because here in the meta model, which you can see, but the arrow is leaving from the event role that is related to the transition. And this means that if I have a button, I cannot connect my button to anywhere else but to the transition, according to this meta model. But it is very easy in C language to write my button code to do all kind of things, like this button is linked to this icon and so forth, which makes no sense. But C language doesn't know the rules of the fish farm or insurance or whatever. This language knows them. So I'm not a Java programmer, but I can make now and generate a Java code because someone has made me this language. Yet I can focus on the business problem that, well, what functionally the customer wants to have. And the example continues. And here I was planning to show the demonstration. We would add here the new variant and generate the code, which I skip now. There is a lot of research done in this field, and there's also standardization bodies which do meta models to standardize languages. And while business modeling was mentioned, Archimate is one such standardization body to make a business modeling language or architecture modeling language. And then there's various kind of tools for people to build meta models and code generators and so forth. Back in the 90s, there was a research here in the University of Jyväskylä on these tools where the company I'm working now, and this is my only sales slide, build a tooling so that there are actually two different roles here if you think this from an organization point of view. There are people who define the languages, and then there are other who build the models based on these languages. Just in a similar manner that there might be some people who make predefined components or frameworks than the others are using. And the process, how it normally goes, if you think how the languages are defined, it normally starts so that you first look what are the key concepts in our domain, like the pond, aerator, whatever, or display, icon, button, and so forth. Every domain has these key concepts. Those you define first. The second step is you look to what are the static syntactic rules there. Can I connect two points together? Can I put points on top of each other? And so forth. You know these kind of what makes sense. And you put those rules to the language so that nobody can make a specification which is illegal. In a similar manner, if I take an analogy to programming languages, you have arbitrary programming languages which support single inheritance, and then you have programming languages which support multiple inheritance among the classes. Those languages have a rule to say, can you write a code to have a multiple inheritance or not? The same kind of rule you have here. And then the third step is that you specify the notation, the concrete syntax, how it looks like. And then the last step is that you write generators. And the generators can be all different kind, not only the code, but they could check the consistency of the model and so forth. And then you can give this for the people to apply. So implementation of languages covers that you define the meta model, the visualization, and then the generators. And depending on the tools, you may also build the tooling and connect it to the other tools and so forth. And then obviously, if your domain evolves, like your framework evolves, then you need to maintain this as well in the longer run. So normally the steps are such that you identify the abstractions, specify the meta model, make the notation, and define the generators. And here are some of the ideas and some of the other example languages. I'm not going to these in detail, but in certain areas, the experts may already have existing jargon or vocabulary, and you can use them. Or if you are, let's say, in a railway systems and you have building interlocking systems, they are already drawing these kind of railway station signaling lighting models. Then you can build a domain-specific language that allows to operate with the concepts natural for the railway systems. Or this is the modeling language for car infotainment system. So today, high-end cars may have more than 1,000 menu items in the infotainment system. And they want to design them carefully so that if someone is driving in Autobahn 200 kilometers an hour, he could do the setup quickly. So someone must design the usability side. So they use modeling languages for that, and then they can generate a simulation to try it out whether it's still working. And here are, looking that I have too many slides, like I already warned myself, is that if you can use already known concepts from your domain, you should use them in the modeling language, if you are in every situation that you are building a language. And then you can normally find them from the specifications, you can find them from the architecture, or you can find from the customers what kind of features they want to have. And if you have defined the language concepts, then the next step is that you build the meta model, just like I was building the meta model for parameter lists and so forth. So rather than having just thinking you actually start the modeling. So as you noticed, we are eating our own dog food here. We are also doing modeling when we are building the meta models, which means that we trust on what we are saying. Because if you build a meta model, then there are these tools, number of these tools, which allow you to test is your language correct. So you can, like I was showing, that let's add a parameter. One second later, I can try out what it looks like. So you can test your ideas, and then you can decide things like if I have a. Maybe I can show now the video. Because this was the meta modeling video, and not the modeling video. But the use case is here that there is a need to express long pressing button policy. So here in the design, we have this line coming from up button. And now the company has that we can only press once the code, but we would like that in our modeling language we can express button pressing where we keep the button pressed for a long time. And now the decision for language developer is that we can go to the meta model and change this language, which we are now using but currently can't express long button pressing policy. So this concept is called event, and now the expert goes to the meta modeling tools. This is the meta edit from the company I work for. And here you can see then the concept here called all the modeling concept of this language, like actions, buttons, and so forth. But we can also see here the event. And here we then add a new property for this event, so for this line over here. So the person who makes the meta model says that, oh, I want a new property here called long press. And he adds that concept to the meta model at the same time when other colleagues could be modeling and building the systems. And this long press could be of different type. For this case, it's just a Boolean value. Is it long press button policy or not? But it could be more complex. And when the meta model is saved, so press it save here, at the same time, other people can click these events to decide if it is long pressing or not. So now in the modeling language, you can see there is a Boolean decision to be made because the meta model was extended. So now only the selected event is long pressing. And then also here, a concrete syntax is defined. Because in the model, we cannot yet see which one is long pressing. So therefore, it is decided that this kind of ellipse is added to illustrate cases where long pressing button policy is applied. So someone, we as humans, can immediately see from the diagram that, okay, this kind of symbol is given. And then in this particular moment in the video, they enter here a condition. So this red ellipse only if the long pressing value is true. So once the concrete syntax is accepted, now the model shows here that this is long press. And then I think also the second button is made long press, and therefore we exchange the capabilities of our modeling language, and now we can express more things from this area. Obviously, we cannot generate the code yet, but what could be done is that here is currently generated C code. I'm showing this because we look next to generators. Currently, my C code does not know anything about this long pressing button policy because we just added to that. So the last step would be that we have the meta model, the rule, and the notation. The last step is that we would implement the generator. So here you can see three generators, C, Java, and C#. And now in the video, there is made an extension to the generator. So this is a generator script that reads the model to produce the C code. And now here it is added that if the button pressing policy is long pressed And here the metamodal concepts are accessed. So if it is an event is pressed, and this is a long press, then generate something. In this case, it generates some literal string called long. So now the generated code should, in cases of long pressing button policy, it should show this string. So when the code is being generated, here is the debugger of the generator. So code is being generated now, and the generator is executed. And some point of time, it gets here to the long pressing button policy. So now the generator should produce button name with the long string as it is now doing. And then we could run this. We get the C code, which we could compile and put to the digital watch and run it. So this is the idea of model-based development, that you define a metamodel first. Here is a metamodel of UML class diagrams. I know that you are familiar with UML. One portion of it is the class diagrams, maybe the most used approach. But this defines all the key concepts of UML class diagrams. Therefore, after defining this metamodel, you can draw class diagrams as defined here. Or you can build watch-specific metamodels or fish farm-specific metamodels or whatever. It's up to you which is the domain you want to address. And then you can put also rules here. So if I want to do something illegal, unwanted, let's say, if I want to add two buttons together, doesn't make any sense unless we decide that I can press two buttons at the same time. Then it starts to make sense. But let's say that now it doesn't. So I can prevent that my modeling language does not allow me to make such a design which wouldn't work or would lead into a poor performance or for some other reasons. And those rules can be checked when we are modeling. Just like today, if you are writing a code and you have a typo, ID tools tell you that, or even Word tells you that you have misspelling. The same can do a modeling or even say that something is missing now. So you can't have a button without a name, for instance. And then you can show these rules when you want. And you can also draw the notations. Quite often the notations are just black and white, but there's a own area of research for what the visualization of notation should be from cognitive aspects of human, because computers generating the code doesn't care what the model looks like, but we as humans, when we read the models, we care. So if a pond has a blue water, the pond should look like blue kind of things. And it shouldn't be good to have other blue things there as well, because then we wouldn't anymore so easily read the model if there would be just a lot of blue stuff. So there's own area of research for that. And usually the best approach for describing the notations is something like traffic lights or signs. So you have a minimum information that you know what it is, and then you have still space for design information. So having something pixel or photos, they would be bad because you start to think other things than the relevant parts. And there are also guidelines given for the visualizations. But let me go into the code generators then. Because if you do model, and this is how I started, if you do models, it would be nice to have something else than the guys in the beginning had that, oh, we have rectangles. It would be nice if we would have something that we could generate something out. And what the code generator basically do is it goes into the model, travels there in the model, and takes the data from the model and puts it out into some output syntax. You could even consider that like traveling in the city with a map. You have some starting place, and then you travel in the city map, and whatever you see, you can take the data out and put it into output streams to generate the code. And then meanwhile, while you are doing, you can also do some translations. Like if a person enters the name of the pond with let's say, with the white space, which is illegal as a variable. You cannot use the name of the pawn then variable name. You can run a translator that makes that name that the person is giving into something that is a legal variable in language X. And there are different ways that your navigation works. So if you have a flow or state machine based, you could have some start state and then your generator goes there depth first or breadth first and takes the data out. Or if you have a structural model, you could have a model that travels only a certain kind of connections first, or you could have a generator that looks relationships first and the objects later and so forth. And then you can basically generate the code in almost any structure. It could be function call, so you generate function and another function calls another function. Or you have a sequential, or you have a case switch sentences, like in the C code there was that I showed in the video, or you have a transition tables where you have a generated table where you have all the transitions that are possible, and then the transitions are described in detail elsewhere. And all code can never be generated. So in theory, obviously, you can build a modeling language that allows to do everything, but nobody most likely would try to use that. So it's better to build a generator for most repetitive areas and focus there first, because then you can quickly deliver the benefits to the company. And in academia, many people try to build a generator which is universal, because that's the whole point of academic research, to find theories that are applicable everywhere. But when you are building a generator, it's best to focus that you can build code for your systems only. So you don't need to care about competing fish farm company. You just want to build your, and not even think about what could we use this language to generate also the banking application. Just focus on the specific domain that you are doing, because then life becomes much more simpler. And when you build a generator, you should always try to build a generator so that you don't need to touch the generated code. Just like in a compilers, that when you compile, you don't go and change the assembler code and then continue normally. And then you try to put the rules to the language so that if you give a model, for example, in my joke where the guys were drawing the boxes, it would be impossible to generate anything meaningful there. And not only because the concepts would be vague, but also we don't know if the model is correct. There could be blue things connected which shouldn't be connected kind of things. But if we can put these rules to the language, like two buttons in a digital watch cannot be connected, or two pawns cannot be on top of each other and so forth, then we can prevent people to make illegal specifications. And when we write the code generator, we know that the model is correct. We don't need to check first, oh, I get some kind of designs. Does this design make sense? So if the design is immediately correct, then the building a generator becomes easier. Also, some companies, we have been working in some companies where we generate masses of code, and they like it. Obviously, it looks great that if you can generate a lot of code, but if you start to seeing in the generated code a lot of repetition, it's better to take that repetition and put into underlying framework so that you can generate less code and your generator is simpler. And also, many people who have heard about code generators, they don't normally like it because they have user experiences from using code generators from, let's say, from UML tools, where someone makes a generator for everybody. And different companies have different programming styles. They use different libraries, so it's practically impossible that there would be a UML tool vendor which provides Java generator that works for everybody. So And often when programmers see the generated code, they say that, oh, I wouldn't do that way. It doesn't look nice. If something happens with the tool, I need to maintain this generated code and it will be horrible. But if you here make, that's also our advice, we ask the best programmer in the house, Bill, write the code, and then we try to use that as a reference code for the generator. So we try to generate the code as the best programmer writes it today. And while asking that, we'll find out that there is a lot of horrible code in the company. Because we as humans don't always follow the good practices. So if you can generate the good-looking code, whatever that good-looking means, it's different from the companies, but then programmers feel confident that, oh, what the generator produces it, I can maintain this, I understand this. Just like me, when I'm buying a car, early days I wanted to know what's under the hood, nowadays I don't care. It's not any more interest after you know that, okay, car is moving. The same happens with code generators. You don't know what's going on in the assembler. I wrote the assembler program. I don't know what's going on there. I don't want to know what's going there. The same happens here. Since all code cannot be generated and you always have an existing code, one key issue has always been when using generators is that what I do with my existing legacy code or code that I'm not able to generate. How to generate code and have manually written code. And there are different strategies for doing that. One of them, and most common, like in the fish farm and in even in our digital watch, is that you have existing components and your generated code calls the services of the component. If I'm using the watch as an example, we do not have manually written. We don't generate each button code. We have a manually written button component, and then we generate each button that calls the services of the framework button. So we generate down button, up button, and so forth. But all the functionality is provided by the framework. So we are just calling the existing services. Another approach, of course, nothing prevents us to do it vice versa. If you're using object-oriented programming languages like we were doing this, not in the C example, but in the C# and Java example, we have an abstract classes, and then we are generating subclasses. The abstract classes, which are the superclasses, they provide the basic functionality, and then we are generating subclasses that inherit the functionality provided by the framework. If you are using some program, or you can do it vice versa, if you are doing some programming languages like C#, that is wonderful news, because C#, unlike Java for instance, C# has a concept of partial class. So you can have one class which is halfly generated and halfly manually written. It's still the one class. So Microsoft has done something nice in terms of generating the code and writing the code compared to some other languages. Then you may have component, framework, and then in the framework you may have hooks where you're actually generating the code. So you have a framework template, and then you are filling the template with your generated code. And this allows you to change the templates and then run the generator again from your models to fill that. Or you do something what is called protected regions, that you generate the code, but then at the same time you generate the code regions where you can write your own code. And the next time when you run a code generator, checks the checksums from your changes. So if you have written your own code there into the generated file, the next generation does not overwrite them. So you have a file, you generate it, you modify your file. in certain areas, and when you run again, your own stuff still stays there, plus you get the new stuff from the model, or updated stuff, or remove stuff from the model. And that's called protected regions. So these are the normal mechanisms, depending on the case, on how you combine generated code with the existing code that you may have. And obviously, here in the software development course, we are mostly keen on producing the code, but quite often you get major benefits by also generating other kind of things than code. You can generate configuration, make files, test scripts, installation guidelines, and so forth. And actually, model-based testing is one area where people are using it a lot. I also started that this gives a productivity increase, and I didn't prove that, but I would like to conclude you by motivating you that if you want to make a big difference to your current practices wherever you go into working in the industry, there is a clear evidence that if you can raise the level of abstraction higher with the languages, the productivity will for sure improve. In a similar manner, the productivity increased when you move from MassAssembly to Fortran or C. And here are some statements from different companies. This is the master thesis from Juha Kärnä from Oulu from Polar, Sykemittarit. And also here, EADS, on that side of the building, they are also building the radio terminals by using domain-specific language generators. And here are a couple of examples. This is the only allowed idea to show from Polar. So you can see the domain-specific language has displays, navigations, and so forth, and then they generate the products they want. And they also have done some return of investment calculations. They used 7 or 8 days to build their modeling language and C code generator. And then they could start using it. This is from Japan, from Panasonic, home automation, a modeling language which builds two kind of systems for controlling home. So you can see a wall-mounted device. And in Japan, they like these kind of systems. You can control air, ventilation, heating, burglary alarms from your home. But then they also build a second generator that they have this kind of cheap device providing the same functionality where you have this kind of roller and you can choose there a remote control your house without going to the wall. And they have done the similar kind of things. And then the last example is from Finland, from military radio network testing. This is a language used for test engineers. And the test case here on the bottom says basically that something like device one is making point-to-point call to device three, and after 2 seconds ends the call, and after 1 second makes a device seven makes a group call, and after 5 seconds ends the call for all testing devices in this network. And then it generates the test script in TTC and 3 language used for testing. And I was in a meeting when they were presenting this, and the guy said that, look, now I'm doing in an afternoon the same thing I did last week. So that's a way how some companies measure the influence of the productivity. It looks so clear that doesn't make sense to write the things manually if we can generate it. So with these examples, I would like to conclude and hope that you remember these four things. Number one, I hope I was able to show you that if we raise the level of abstraction, the productivity will increase. And that's how our industry have evolved. And most likely it will continue that way. It's not the Moore law, but that's how things have been moving. And currently it looks like that it is next to impossible to build general purpose modeling language which would allow code generation. So the modeling languages mostly look domain specific. So they focus on a certain business problem and then they can generate the code. And then the second and third thing means that in order to have these kind of things, you have to build the meta models. So you need, or someone in your company needs to define the abstractions and the rules and the generators that you can have this productivity jump. And normally, the persons which you have not experienced yet, but I would like to challenge you to try it out, because if you build the language, it moves you to the next, not next level is not necessarily the right word, but it moves you to the view that you are not anymore building a single system, but you're actually looking you are not building a single fish farm for customer X, but you're actually looking at the problem point from the point of view that what kind of fish farms we can actually build for any customer. And obviously, if you are in your future position, a person who can think what all different kind of products we can build, it's more likely that you are in a better position than if you are building a single system. Plus, it's mentally claimed to be fun. Maybe the fun starts only when you have been doing a single system for a while and you are fed up of that type of thing. But then raising the level of abstraction and building language and generators can be very good for your career path. Because you can imagine if you are build a generator and languages and the company is productive, most likely you are among the top resources in that company then. I can't promise, but it's likely. So if you want to study further things, there is quite a lot of research done in the area, still in academic world as well. And the Hutchinson study and the Whittle study are those which give a current good view of state of the practice. And the last one is also freely available from InfoQ if you want to read. Any questions? I have asked that yesterday, because I have this hobby and I'm still writing a conference, hopefully a conference paper, where we try to look what is the cost of building these languages. But here are three cases: building this kind of language to generate was 10 days. Building Panasonic was 15 days, and building the Polar was 7 or 8 days.
And how many people
was
doing?
One. Only one. I think the consultant from VTT was building this one together with the guy from Electric. I don't know how they did it. But it's not something like building a new Java language, which you need to standardize, and let's wait for a couple of years, and then we have the language. So this is something that you could do in a relatively short period of time. Thanks for the good question.
Paper, it's a reference that say that usually expert programs don't like
it. Yeah.
So
just like assembler programmers hated Fortran and C. Because they were the king of assembler programming, and suddenly it wasn't any more needed. Or it wasn't sudden. But they say that it's a threat. And that doesn't look great if we are experts of assembler with the processor X0 style of assembler, then I would hate that. So if you are good in a certain programming language, this is a threat for your career.
The other parts, there are invisible. That, I have to trust.
Yeah, but then, and there is a certain mentality of people to say, code is king. I don't trust anything else. I just write code and that's king. But that kind of argument is so easily to destroy, because then you can ask from the person to say, have you ever speak to the guy who make the compiler? Because the guy who make a compiler says that, by the way, your C code, It's just a model, because he's doing the real stuff. So it's your perspective where you are. And another thing that people are afraid of, oh, will this take, if you have studied here programming, will this take your career path, or what will happen to the industry itself? I think that the software industry has only grown because the abstraction has raised. So when we get the newer languages, the pool of developers just became bigger. And we have more software than ever if we would stick with binary. Everybody would be still writing a very easy course in programming. Keywords are 2, 0, and 1, and then you go. It would be very difficult to build the software. And we wouldn't have so much software, and our industry wouldn't be so big as it is today, for sure. But in a short-term, primitive reaction is that, oh, this is a bad for my career as a good Java programmer.
What did you say about maturity or popularity of this? Because some of the references are from the early 2000s, and then I saw some years in your slides earlier, 2000-2005, and still today, 2017, we're doing Java code.
Sure. Good. If you are in an industry where the technology changes a lot, let's say you are making a browser software. Now it was mandatory to be a Flash. Oh, now it must be HTML7. Now it must be Ruby on Rails or whatever. If you are in a fast pace of technology change and there come frameworks all the time, then it takes time to build the language generators. And if you build that, next month there might be a new framework and you need to integrate with that. So if the technology is changing, then you don't want to do that. In other industries, like say automotive, where still cars are written in C, and they need to maintain it long time, they use a lot of modeling. I guess most of the software today in a car is generated. It's not written manually, because the languages and frameworks don't change like fashion. So there's a big difference in the industries. And last point that I would like to mention here is that there is also our industry is very interested on bringing new passwords. One of them, which I like a lot, but people say it's low code. So you have environments like Mendix or Q Systems. I don't now remember the name, but environments which provide you higher abstraction for building basic web applications, and they provide you the runtime environment as well as the cloud where you're executing it, but they also provide low code or citizen code coding environments where you can, with little code, you can get a lot of functionality. So that's also one maybe growing trend. And also in here in Jyväskylä, there are consulting companies which use, for example, our tool to build project-based systems. But it is true that the references we have, or I was showing, are old, mostly because I have been lazy and not updating them. And another thing is that it's not easy to get the reference either. So it takes you need to ask a permission from company to take the reference. Thanks for the question. So let me then ask quick poll. Is this a threat for developers? Hands up. Great. Do you think that, who thinks that this is not a threat for developers? Okay, interesting.
It's an opportunity you have planned to learn.
Yes. And of course, there must be someone who builds the frameworks, there must be someone who builds the generators and so forth. So just like there are people who build compilers and linkers and virtual machines and such. Okay, enjoy your studies here.